Thanks, Manu. Okay, so first, we have a guest, I believe, today. So we'd like to—I'd always like to start with introductions. So, Pari, would you be willing to introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Pari. I'm an engineer from Intuit. We're working on a project that's involving blockchain, which obviously identity is a big part of. So I'm here to just learn mostly on mute, but maybe in the future we will be bringing other engineers as well.
Okay, thank you. Who joined from area code 541? I'm sorry, your voice is distorted. Who is that?
That was Nate Otto.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks. Oh, Nate, you just missed being scribe. So, anyway, welcome. Okay. So now let's look at the agenda. Is there anyone who has any comments, suggestions for changes to the agenda? Okay. No comments. Then we will move on to the vote for verifiable claims. Do you want to give us an update, Manu, on that?
Sure. So the vote kicked off a couple of weeks ago, a week or two ago. We've had some healthy input, meaning like we're above the minimum threshold at W3C for the vote, quote unquote, succeeding. But that doesn't mean that let's just say the people that have weighed in right now are small companies, and W3C expects some fairly large companies to participate as well. We have like one or two that have said that they'll participate in the work, but we need a couple more. We have contacted 225 people about the vote. So that is currently in process. We have new members that are joining W3C specifically for the verifiable claims vote, the verifiable claims work. So everything's looking good. We just need to keep on the AC reps to make sure that they see the request to vote. It's the middle of the holidays, which makes things difficult on everyone. If you need the link, the vote link is here. Again, this is only for W3C members. W3C member only vote link for verifiable claims. Richard, the vote closes January 15th, so you definitely want to get your vote in by January 14th. So yeah, I mean, things are good. We still need to respond to Microsoft and Mozilla on the AC forum. They've sent a bunch more, a bunch of questions in. And primarily we need to answer them because they could still formally object to the charter. So we're good for now.
Manu, who did you say we need to respond to, Microsoft and who?
Mozilla. Well, I mean, Tontech. The good news is that, we had assumed that there were four companies that were pushing against it fairly hard, and we just flat out asked them, or do they intend to block it? And all of them but two of them said that, two of the four said that they don't have no intention of blocking. They're just trying to make sure that we've, got all of our I's dotted and T's crossed. The other two didn't say anything. But we've got a healthy amount of interest in the votes so far, so that's a really good sign.
All right, thanks. Any questions from anyone about that? Okay. Thank you. All right, moving on to the next agenda item. Time on weekly calls is precious. Use GitHub for discussions. So the chairs were talking, and we're discussing how we want to have work in the group proceed and how to make, in particular, how to make best use of the precious teleconference time, right, when we all give up time in our schedules at the same time of the day to be on these calls. So we think, given that we have GitHub and we are encouraging people to have discussion on GitHub, we believe that the best thing for right now, definitely, is to have the discussions happen as much as possible on GitHub. So we encourage you to post issues as you have them, as you encounter them in GitHub. We also would like to encourage everyone to scan the list of issues in GitHub and comment on any that you have an opinion on. Our goal as chairs is going to be to make sure that there is as good a review as possible of each issue before we make a determination on whether it's an issue that's going to require some kind of change to the specification or something else. And so we definitely need those reviews to happen. The other thing that we will do is we will then begin allocating conference call time, our teleconference time, to issues that we believe can benefit from that discussion time. So an example would be if there's an issue that is stuck, appears to be stuck in some way, there are differing opinions on how to proceed, then we will probably schedule that for a teleconference. Otherwise, you may begin seeing us requesting specific proposals. So if you post an issue, we might then ask you to make a suggestion for what you would like to happen. But in any case, the key here is that the teleconference time is precious. So please do start looking at the issues on GitHub. And thank you, Manu, for putting that in the in IRC. Are there any questions about that right now? This is not really, by the way, this is not anything different from what we've been saying for a couple weeks now. But we just want to really reinforce this that we're going to be using GitHub as the initial place where questions should be raised. Any questions? Okay, great.
We've got a queue, Dan.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, Manu.
I wanted to circle back around to Pari from Intuit a couple of agenda items back. Pari, this group is very quickly going to move into kind of a W3C member-only group, which means you need to be a W3C member to participate in the calls themselves. There are multiple ways to kind of get involved. You can just go through the issue tracker and communicate via the issue tracker. I don't know if Intuit is a W3C member or not, but that's something that we may want to take offline and chat about with the chairs of the group. Clearly, you're very welcome to participate. We'd love to have Intuit's input and collaboration. The other thing that you may not know is that we have an IRC chat channel where we're scribing and sharing links right now. So if you go to irc.w3.org, #VCTF Verifiable Claims Task Force VCTF, you should be able to get in. Dana, I wanted to make sure that new folks had that data. That's it for me.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much.
I'll look into if we have W3C membership because we definitely want to participate in this group. If not, for the time being, I can definitely follow you guys through the other mediums you suggested.
Great. If you're a W3C member, there's no issue. Join anytime. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Johnny, I think you're next.
Yeah, I think mostly it was just which GitHub repository. And I thank you, Manu, you actually put it up there. But I think last week, actually, we were talking about prioritizing the issues. There's actually, I read through them all finally, and actually there's some overlap. And I think maybe it might be a good worth the time to consolidate them and prioritize.
Yeah, so prioritization, I understand what you're saying. Prioritization can be tricky. And so in W3C, as a consensus-based organization, ultimately we must attempt to address every issue. And so we may consolidate some, but we want to be careful not to miss any issues. That's particularly important. So one of the things the chairs are still discussing is, you know, at what point we need to do a prioritization within the group. You know, at what point we might need to do some prioritization. I'll tell you that right now we just have a lot of issues to go through. Okay, so our prioritization right now is going to be based largely on, again, making sure that we get discussion on the issues that are out there. So you'll begin to see some of the editorial ones getting cleaned up. I didn't have time this week to push some of those into the document, but we'll be doing that before I stop for the holidays. Is there something in particular you wanted to say about prioritization, other than just that there are some related issues?
No, I think there are certainly some issues that have a lot of overlap or redundancy, and so I think, and then there's just a lot of issues. And I think just the one that I tried tackling was could have been a whole hour conversation and a rat hole to sort of go down. And so I think really having consensus of which are the hot topics that need to be hashed out sooner than later, and then which ones may be redundant and could be consolidated. And maybe
right.
Actually I'll do that all through making comments in the issues.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, again, my personal preference is to be careful with removing issues as duplicates. I know that's not what you're saying. You're actually saying that there's some overlap. We may combine some issues, but when you do that, the history can get muddled as well. So I think some of this is going to happen organically, frankly. You know, as you comment in one and someone comments in one, it's our job as chairs and everyone in the group, but definitely our job as chairs to make sure that if we notice that certain issues are overlapped and they get to where they need to be discussed together, then what we are likely to do is to just schedule, you know, these three issues will be discussed together in this call. Right, and that might be a good way of doing it. We might alternatively decide to replace them with one combined issue. But again, you know, my personal preference is to be a little careful with doing that to make sure we don't lose anything that the person who submitted an issue considers important. All right, thanks. Any other comments or questions on that?
Yeah, Matt's still on the
queue. Thank you.
excuse me, I got a frog in my throat this morning. I was just going to add to what Daniel said there. Dan said, as chairs, one of the things we were talking about last week is starting to introduce a fairly coarse grain kind of prioritization scheme on the issues of sort of a later as the ones that would go into a parking lot or could come later in our process. And another tag that could be something like requires discussion. And those are the ones that we would expect to drive some conversation on GitHub in and eventually come up to this group as a call if we can't reserve it in GitHub. But we are trying to push the groups to work throughout the week in GitHub, in the issue tracker, so that conversations are happening ongoing, not just in 1 hour a day or a week, which I'm not claiming is the case. But look for that kind of prioritization to start coming up. We're not looking for 1, 2, 3, 4 as kind of an ordinal prioritization, but some coarse grain categories so we know what might be coming up in the next couple of calls.
All right. Thanks. Any other questions or comments? Okay. I'm going to move on to the next item now, a brief intro to GitHub pull requests. This is something that I received as a request. I think it actually might be worth checking, since I just talked about how valuable teleconference time is, to find out if people actually want me to walk through this at this point. I sent it out a week ago. Obviously, there's an opportunity for questions to come up if I walk through it. I'm going to ask two questions. I'm going to ask, is there anyone who specifically wants me to do it? And then I'm going to ask if there's anyone who specifically thinks we should not walk through it today. So first, is there anyone who particularly would like for me to walk through the slides I sent for last week? That's just a very brief intro to GitHub pull requests.
I think it would be helpful, Dan, and I can understand that some people might be shy. So at least having the link in the minutes for people to kind of thumb through, I think would be helpful.
Right. Yeah, and so for those of you, by the way, who are wondering where links are, all the links are in the agendas, but I will go ahead and drop the link here. Second question, is there anyone who particularly does not want to go through it?
Yeah, I can pass. This is John. Johnny.
Okay. There are, I think we have a good number of people who are not developers on this call. Thank you, Johnny. I think Manu has convinced me that we should go ahead and go through it at least quickly. And you know, if people don't have questions, then fine, we'll move really quickly. And if they do, then that is hopefully valuable. All right, so I sent this the link there. Please do follow along. If you have a GitHub account, feel free to go to your GitHub account and actually pull up the link for the repository, which is right here. Okay. But if you're logged into your account, then you can actually follow along as I go through this. Okay, so slide one is just a title, so let's move on. Slide two. Very briefly, I know, again, a number of people are not familiar with Git or GitHub. So Git is a revision control system. I'll be talking a bit more about what that means. And it's primarily command line driven. In what I'm going to show today, I'm actually not going to show any command line control. We'll get to that in part two, because you're going to have to once we get beyond the simple stuff. And GitHub is just a site that hosts Git repositories. That's, you know, at its core, that's what it is. It's a web host for Git repositories. Slide three. By the way, the way I'm looking at the slides, I can't tell if there's has a question that pops up on the queue. So please, Manu or Matt, feel free to just interrupt me if someone's on the queue, okay?
Sure, I'll monitor. One, just really quickly, I am converting your slides to Google Slides so everyone can see it. I don't have PowerPoint.
I'm sorry. You know what? I normally send out a PDF. I can't believe I didn't do that.
That's fine. Yeah. Here's the link. So slides.
Yep.
Say,
yeah, in Google. Fact, I normally get on to people pretty hard for sending PowerPoints instead of PDFs. So I'm surprised I did that. My future ones will all be PDFs. Okay. All right, so slide three. So what does it mean to be a revision control system? A revision control system tracks changes to a collection of files. The most common use for revision control systems nowadays is for code, where you have several different code files, whether it's JavaScript or C or Java or whatever. And you want to be able to keep track of changes that you've made so that you can actually revert to an earlier stage if necessary. Let's say you mess something up and you want to back up. Or you just need to keep track because you want to be able to differentiate between the code that was used in a release and the code that you're working on currently. So you need a way to actually track changes in those files, but you need to be able to track them all together, right? So you want to know that that this version of this file and this version of this file and this version of this file all went together, and not track them individually. So Git is a revision control system, and that's what it does. In Git, each saved change, that doesn't mean each edit that you make to a file, but each saved change is called a commit. So there's a specific process you do with Git to make a commit. We're going to look at that in a moment. So you can change as many files as you want, and you can modify each one as much as you want, but Git doesn't care about that until you actually do a commit. In Git, that commit is represented by a hash value. You don't really need to know what that means, except that it's just a bunch of it's a string of letters and numbers. And it is that string of letters and numbers is used as the reference for that commit as well. So that's something that, again, more as we get into part two, you may care about. You may want to look at what the commit hash values are. The other thing that a commit has, and this is actually fairly important, is a commit message explaining what the commit is for. Normally, it's a very brief message, and it can be as brief as fixed a typo. It could be added new section on such and such. But typically, those are the kinds of commits that commit messages that you'll see.
Hey, Dan.
Yes.
Manu's on the queue.
Okay.
Hey, Dan. I'm wondering if we should not go into this much detail. So the thing I thought would be useful to folks is for them to know that, you know, there are two ways to get heard. One of them is comment on the issue and ask for a change, and the second one is to do a pull request. I don't know if it's a good use of our time to go into how Git works or how version control systems work.
So Manu, have you looked at the rest of the slides?
Yeah, I have. So I was just wondering if we could time box this for like 15 minutes.
So that is the original time box, is 15
okay.
minutes.
Okay, good.
I think it will actually take 20. I only reduced it to 15 because I was, worried about the schedule. But my intent was to just, if I don't talk about this, then the moment I show what you do in GitHub, people will
sure.
be lost.
Okay.
Unfortunately. I will go faster. Okay, I hope you're all ready. Here we go. All right, slide 4, repositories. So when you make a commit, that commit is done in a specific repository. That is a specific collection of files. You can clone a repository to make a brand new separate one. So if I clone your repository, I really do have my own separate copy. That's an important thing to be aware of when we get later on in the slides. Okay, 5. Branches. Any work you do within a repository, all commits that you do are done on a branch. The default branch for Git is master, but most W3C specs use ghpages as the default branch. It's trivially easy to create new branches in Git, and Git is specifically designed to make it to encourage the use of frequent branching. So once you've worked on a new branch, you can then merge your changes, your commits on that branch, onto a different one. So a common workflow is to branch from whatever your default branch is, to make your edits, commit your changes, and then merge those changes, merge that branch into the default branch. Okay, slide 6. So GitHub. I mentioned that GitHub is basically web hosting for repositories. But additionally, it adds a little bit of magic to both repositories and branches to enable a model called the fork and pull model. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. But the reason for this is that GitHub wanted to make it really easy for people who were not the official editors of a document to be able to propose changes. Right, so I'm officially one of the editors of the data model specification, but for anyone else who isn't officially one of the editors, you may still want to say, here, I suggest you make these changes, and the fork and pull model makes that actually very easy to do. Now, GitHub itself provides only limited document editing and committing capabilities within the web interface of GitHub. There is a GitHub desktop, which I'm not going to go into. I'm going to talk when I do part two about how you do stuff on the command line, which is really where most of your editing and committing are probably going to happen. Now, why is it that GitHub only provides this limited amount? It's because the details of branching and commits and so on that I'm going to show you a very brief overview. But once you get into the details of it, particularly when you need to fix something that you've done, you made a mistake somewhere, the merging didn't go well, it can get really complicated in a hurry to figure out exactly how that should work. And so, you know, that's not really GitHub's job, is to figure that out. So it doesn't try to make that that easy. So it just gives you very simple capabilities that I'm going to show you in a moment. Okay, now with slide 7. So within repositories, within GitHub, the way you create a repository is you fork an existing one to create a clone. That creates a new copy of that current of that repository in your account. And I'm going to show you an example in just a moment. Now the cool thing about this copy is that it knows where it was forked from. And that's particularly helpful when it comes to creating pull requests, and GitHub makes that easy. So when you create pull request, any pull request you create is created from your fork. Okay? It's not created from the original repository. It's your forked copy that you create a PR in. And I have a link that I'm not going to go through. There's just for people who are wondering what the difference is between forking and cloning, that's somewhat advanced, but I have a reference here for when you're more of an expert down the road. Okay, slide 8. So I'm showing here the original data model repository. And if you look in the upper left corner of this slide, you'll see opencred/vcdatamodel. So you know that this is in the OpenCred's repository, and it's the it's data model that we're looking at. So there's a data model repository in the OpenCred's account. Actually, if you look, just look down below where it says 145 commits, also, and you'll see where it says branch GH pages. So that shows you the branch that you're on. And again, by default, since this is a, we're doing this as a W3C spec, or as if it were a W3C spec, our default branch is GH pages. So that's what you're going to expect to see whenever you look at this particular repository, the source repository. In the upper right corner, there's a fork button. You'll see I circled it there. And if you click that button, then when you go to slide 9, you'll see what you get. In my case, in my BurnBurn account, there is now a data model, VC data model repository. And you'll notice this is in the upper left corner of that slide that I'm looking at. You'll notice that right underneath that it says where it's forked from OpenCred's VC data model. So my repository in GitHub knows that it came from the OpenCred's version of this repository. Okay, slide 10. One quick thing before we go to slide 10 is if you look again under the 145 commits and under branch GH pages, you'll see this branch is even with OpenCred's colon GH pages. So at the moment, that tells you that that we are in sync with that original repository's branch. Okay, slide 10. Now we can talk about pull requests. So all a pull request is a collection of changes, a collection of commits, to be specific, to the original repository. And the nice thing about it is that very often it can be easily pulled in, which is why it's called a pull request, pulled in or merged into the original repository by the maintainers of that repo. Slide 11. A pull request is created from a branch in your repository. So you're going to have a branch to create a pull request, and we'll see an example in a moment. GitHub figures out the differences between that original repo and your current branch in your repo and turns it into a pull request. From then on, any changes that you make to your own branch, any additional commits you make to your own branch, are automatically updated in the pull request. until it's merged, of course, okay, or closed. But that's particularly useful because if there's discussion on that pull request and someone says, hey, can you modify it to do this, all you have to do is make additional commits on that branch and it will automatically show up in the pull request. Just checking, nobody on the speaker queue yet. Okay. Okay. Slide 12. So what I'm going to walk through in this specific case using my repository as an example is creating a single simple pull request in GitHub using the very limited capabilities available in GitHub itself. And I have a link here. Feel free to look at that link at some point later. That actually walks you through these steps in general, is how you can do this within GitHub. So what we're going to do is create a branch. We're going to edit a file, in this case just one file, and we're going to commit the changes and then create a pull request from that. Slide 13. So creating a branch. So now here I am looking at my data model repository in my BurnBurn account. And if you look under where it says branch GH pages that we were looking at before, all I did was I clicked on that and then I started typing in the text box. I typed demo-branch. And GitHub offered to create that branch for me since it didn't already exist. So basically this pull-down menu will list other branches that you can switch to and look at within your repository. In my case, I wanted to create a new one, so I just started typing the name. And then when GitHub offered to create that branch, I clicked where I have it circled. Slide 14. Notice at the top it now says branch created. Okay. And if you look under 145 commits where it lists the branch, it shows the branch, it actually shows demo branch as the one that we're working in right now. So now I want to edit index.html, which is our data model spec document. So if I just click on that name, index.html, we go to slide 15. And now you can see the contents of that file. Okay, that's what we're looking at here, all the lines of code here. And if you look then off to the right side, you'll see that I've circled this little pen icon. And if you click that, you can now edit the file. So clicking that will take me to slide 16, where I now have an opportunity to edit this particular file. And notice that, so I've circled two things. The lower item that I've circled is where I typed in an ignore me comment after the head element. So I typed that in, and then I clicked the Preview Changes tab that I've also circled. Slide 17. At this point, Git shows me the diff between the original file and my changes. So you can see that on line 3, all I've really done is added the ignore me comment. Now, there's also a place for me to fill in a commit message, and that's the circled item there under commit changes. I typed in add ignore me comment. Okay, so that's what I did. I'm saying it's basically my pull request is going to be a request to add an ignore me comment. But this is my message for this commit, not my message for the pull request. Okay, when I'm ready to commit this, then I just click the Commit Changes button at the bottom, and that takes us to slide 18. On slide 18, I want you to notice that we're still looking at the file, okay, and it says branch demo branch. Notice that under where we list the branch as demo branch, it now shows that BurnBurn has done a commit whose message is add ignore me comment. So you see that little funky whatever it is, Space Invaders symbol there for me, BurnBurn, add ignore me comment. And if you look to the right of that line, you'll see actually that's the first few characters of the hash, the B555. And it says 2 minutes ago I created a commit on this branch. So circled at the top, what we would need to do next is then go back to the head of the repository. So just click on the, basically you click on the data model there. And that takes us to slide 19. And if you'll notice now, we're back at sort of the main area for our repository. You'll notice that the branch says GH pages again. And notice something else. Just above where it says branch GH pages, there's now a message about a recently pushed branch, and that's the demo branch. So it says that I have a new branch called demo branch, and GitHub is offering to do a compare and pull request, and that's exactly what we want to do. So we click on that button for compare and pull request. That takes us to the open a pull request page where we actually need to give a title and description of the pull request. Now, notice what it did. It actually took my commit message and filled that in as the title for the pull request. Now, we can change that if we want. In my particular case, I wanted to leave it. This should be, regardless of how many commits you have on your branch, you should come up with a message that sort of describes the purpose of the pull request. And in this case, the pull request is to add an ignore me comment. And then I put a description which says, this is a demo PR for the 13 December call, because I had created these slides for last week. Okay, so after updating the title and adding a description, you can click the Create Pull Request button down at the bottom. And that takes us to slide 21. Here's something very important to notice. We're now looking at the pull request, but notice the repository. Notice on the upper left that it's not BurnBurn VC data model anymore. We're now back in the OpenCreds account data model repository. Okay, and we're looking at the pull request there. You'll notice that we're not looking at the code, we're not looking at issues, we're looking at the pull request tab. And we're looking at brand new pull request number 28, where it shows that I want to merge one commit, and it gives the description for my pull request. This is a demo for the demo PR for the 13 December call. This is actually a real pull request that I created, and later, when you look at the repository, you'll actually see this pull request there. Okay, last slide, slide 22. So this is great. Again, this is a very simple pull request. You can do a lot with that, but there is a problem with it, right? So you're not the only one doing pull requests, and the original repository may actually be getting changed in the time that you're working up your pull request. So you know, you create a pull request, then the original repository gets modified, and you want to do another one. But at this point, your repository doesn't match the original OpenCreds repository anymore. So your edits are based on an out-of-date copy. Well, Git and GitHub are fairly smart. If your edits are in a section that hasn't changed at all, Git and GitHub can often figure that out, actually. And so it may still be okay to go ahead and edit the out-of-date copy you have, again, as long as what you're doing doesn't conflict with what's already there. If it does, well, for that we need part two. Okay, so that was a very simple, very, very brief overview. Any questions at this point? Manu.
Yeah, no questions. Thanks, Dan, for going through that. I think the slides are great because people can just, you know, if you didn't quite understand what was going on, you can just kind of step through the slides and they'll walk you through it. Two high-level comments. There are two ways of getting your voice heard, meaning that, you know, the way to get the spec changed. The first mechanism is to comment in the issues, and that's a really simple thing. Like, you just, you know, either open a new issue or join in on an existing issue and start typing. It's like writing out an email for those that are not familiar with GitHub. So it's fairly simple.
And we walked through that a couple weeks ago. I know you're talking for some new people. I'm just reminding those who are on the call that what Manu is talking about is what we discussed a few weeks ago and walked through a few weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
Go ahead.
And that's the easy, like, if you know, there actually I should go back. There are three ways. One, send an email, right? If all else fails, send an email and we'll try to figure out how to raise the issue and discuss it. The second one, which is a bit better, is do the discussion in GitHub on the issue so that we can track your comments on a particular issue and people don't have to figure out which issue you're talking about and so on and so forth. And then the third thing is the pull request, which Dan just went over today. The pull requests are the easiest way for you to get a concrete change into the spec, because if you don't do a pull request, then the editors have to kind of figure out, one, what you're saying, and then two, how to phrase it so that you agree with it and the spec, and it doesn't, you know, mess up the spec. So a pull request takes that mental burden off of the editors and puts it onto you. But the benefit there is that all the editor has to do, you know, after discussing it with the group, is just click merge and the change has been made. So just want to make sure that the people that are new to the group understand that they're easier ways to get your changes into the spec, but this one is usually the most effective.
Right. Thank you very much. Yes, if for some reason this has terrified you, then just submit, then just create an issue instead. Okay? John Tibbett, you're next.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Good. Let's see. So regarding that issue of issues versus pull requests, I assume that I've been putting things into issues because I'm not at the point where I understand enough of the consensus of the group to know to formulate a concrete suggestion. But the question is, when those issues do turn into something that like might be a concrete change in the document, will that be bounced back to us to turn it into a pull request, or will the chairs turn it into a pull request, or how do you foresee that working?
So I'll give you my opinion. I'll just give you my opinion right now, which is that it depends on what the conclusion is, how complex it is, sort of the status of the discussion. What you mentioned as options are all options, right? So if it turns out that there's really clear, concrete, fairly clear agreement on what to do, then the chairs will most likely ask you to create a pull request. If you say, I don't know how to do that or I don't want to do that, then we'll work with you to have another way. But what's going to happen one way or another is eventually specific text has to go in. So even if you're uncomfortable doing a pull request, we might still ask you to send an emailed proposal, for example. But that's not required, and that's why I say it really depends on what the conclusion is. Sometimes the conclusions are ones where it's either pretty clear what the editors need to do, or the editors just need to try something and then have the group review it. That happens sometimes, because sometimes there may be agreement on what's supposed to happen, but you know, if there are 10 different places in the document that need to be updated and kept consistent with other work that the editors know needs to be applied, they may prefer to be the ones to write it up. So I can't tell you right now exactly what's going to happen, but I hope that gives you an idea what some of the options are.
Yep, thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. Then in the remaining time in today's call, I'd like to go to an issue that is ready for some discussion and decision, we believe, and that is use of WebIDL in the spec. It is issue number 4, and unless Manu beats me to it, I'm going to get a link here. So if you just want to pull up that issue. Manu, I don't know whether you copied this over or whether you just raised it originally, but would you be willing to just sort of ask the question and lead the discussion on this?
Sure. So it was raised, for those that don't know what WebIDL is, it's used to express data structures in a number of W3C specifications, typically in browser specifications, but as Dan brought up in the issue, it is its own kind of expression language. The verifiable claim stuff, the data model itself is syntax agnostic, meaning that you should be able to express the data model in XML or JSON or YAML or WebIDL or any of those different syntaxes. We are trying to decide what syntaxes we want to put in the core spec. Right now, I think there's consensus that we put JSON in there, definitely. I think there's kind of loose consensus, rough consensus that we need to get JSON LD in there in some way, shape, or form because people care about semantics in this group. But the question is raised, you know, do we need other syntaxes in the core spec? Do we need WebIDL? Do we need XML or any of those? Or should those go in a separate specification? So that's effectively what this issue is about.
Okay, thanks. I'm seeing that if you're looking at it, looking at that particular issue, you can see that Dave Longley and John Tibbetts were voting for a separate document. John had a question as well. We may come back to that. Then I sort of asked for a little bit more of the reasons for why this particular item should go in a separate document. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of discussion that happened right before the call in the issue tracker. So it may not be the optimal item for discussion today. Again, we're still sort of working into this this model of doing GitHub discussion first. Manu, would you be willing to just sort of argue for why WebIDL in particular should be removed from the document?
Right. So rehashing a bit of what's in the issue, there's, and it really depends on who you ask in W3C. From browser manufacturer perspective, anything that gets implemented in the browsers have to have some WebIDL behind it. In fact, it's usually the technical details are hashed out in the WebIDL. So I think at some point there is going to be a WebIDL expression of the verifiable claims data model if it gets integrated into the browsers. In the meantime, WebIDL looks really strange to those people that are not inside W3C. I don't know of many other organizations that even use it as an expression language. So if we are trying to make the verifiable claims data model spec accessible, we should probably be focusing on just using mechanisms like JSON, you know, just simple diagrams and then JSON to express it in a spec and not add anything in there that's not necessary for at least the basic stuff. So I would argue that, you know, no one in the group is going to be using WebIDL to do implementations at any point in the next 1 or 2 years. We're going to be implementing this stuff via JSON and JSON LD. Because WebIDL is not familiar to a lot of people, that's another argument to not have it in the spec. And we may want to, and another argument is we may want to start creating a mechanism where we define how different syntaxes for verifiable claims are specified, and WebIDL could be the first example of that. So to be clear about it, though, I don't think we should move the WebIDL out until we get into the working group, because that lets us kind of, you know, the working group can decide how it deals with its documents. And if we had some WebIDL in the spec before we went into the working group, then it's a fairly easy argument to kind of separate it into a different specification at that time. So those are just a list of some of the reasons that we may not want to put WebIDL in the core spec, and I see there's a queue.
Thank you. Yes, before I acknowledge Dave, I want to say if there's anyone else who has a comment they'd like to make on this topic, please put yourself on a speaker queue now, because I'm going to freeze it in just about 30 seconds since we are getting towards the end of the call. Okay, Dave.
Right. I think the main reason that you would use WebIDL would be to come up with a specification that browsers could implement. And our charter we've specifically prohibited ourselves from working on any browser specifications. So I feel as though that should go in a separate document that's not part of our deliverables. It could be argued, WebIDL can be more broadly used, obviously, than just in the browser, but at least if we put it in a separate document, it's more clear that we are not violating our charter.
Okay. Thank you. Shane? Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, Shane, before you talk, I'm going to freeze the queue now. That it cannot officially be frozen, as Manu wrote, but John Tippett will be the last one today. That doesn't mean we can't continue discussing this issue, okay? Go ahead, John. Shane.
I guess I agree with you longly that we're not doing stuff that browsers need to implement. Also, it's hard to express this in WebIDL, at least correctly, because WebIDL is broken. However, WebIDL is a W3C rec now, and in the spirit of eating our own dog food, we should at least spec it. So if it's in a separate document, fine, but we shouldn't forget about it.
Okay, thank you. I believe that I'm next. So I agree with all of these comments. As long as it's staying in until we have the working group, and as long as it's not going to get lost, I'm not particularly worried. One of the big, really the only concern I had, frankly, was that it was, I understood, a very important goal for this group to ensure that we define a data model, but also make clear that there are multiple ways that data model can be represented and expressed. And so I think in the end, we would do ourselves a disservice if we only had one syntactic representation in the end document. John?
I think the my recommendation would be that almost just the opposite, that we have only one in the final document, and I think it should be the JSON-LD representation, because the difference between it and the JSON representation is that one is the at context as a first line. And my reason for that is more editorial than it is anything else. There's concepts being introduced before and after we have blocks of code showing how you implement it. And in the long run, I think we should actually have many different forms of representation of what these templates might be. But it's not a good idea to have many pages of this between concept pre the code samples and concepts after. So if we had 30 or 40 pages of different, you'll never get through the concept piece. So I think it makes more sense to have a conceptual model described in this document with a small number of samples of what it looks like, and then have a separate document with many different, which is extensible, with many different representations.
Okay, thank you. I have some. Oh, nice try, Manu. I have some comments as well. We're towards the end of the call. Obviously, there needs to be more discussion. This is a great opportunity now to remind people to continue the discussion in the issue itself, because this, I think, Manu, you're correct that this is really a broader question. It's not perhaps just about WebIDL, but it's up to you if you want to try to restrict it and open a new issue for this. So, any other last statements not about this topic that must be stated before we end the call?
Real quick question, decal, who's decal on IRC?
Hi, that's me. I just came across the standard and saw the schedule for your call and dialed in.
Great. I just need to know your names for the minutes. Or you can stay anonymous and give us an anonymous name. Up to you.
It's Derek Callaway, DerekCallaway.
Thank you, Derek. Appreciate it.
Derek, just to explain briefly, and welcome. One of the reasons for this is that eventually this group will be producing specifications, and ultimately anyone who makes suggestions or contributions in any form, we need to understand what sort of the IP, intellectual property status might be of anything that they say. So that's just, you know, this is a, it's just a requirement as we do, as we move into doing the official specification work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if I didn't want it to be known, I wouldn't have said it out loud. So,
sure.
Yeah, you know, whatever.
All right, that's thank
cool.
you. Okay, thank you, everyone. Reminder, there is no call next week. Our next call is first Thursday in January, I believe. I don't have the date. Do you remember, Matt, offhand?
Tuesday or Thursday?
I think it's the third.
I'm Tuesday. I can't believe I said Thursday. Tuesday. Yeah, I think it's the third, too. All right, thank you. And yes, welcome, Decal.
Thanks all. Bye.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Have a good day.